runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 291 with guest Steve Evans, recorded Tuesday, October 30th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. And I'm home briefly in the midst of the gigantic .NET Rocks Visual Studio 2012 launch road trip. And if you haven't heard about this, take a look at .NETRocks.com and click on the big road trip link. I get a week off. It's the week of build, although you're listening to the show sometime later. And so I'm actually home. Did some laundry, very romantic process, but it's good to be home for a little while, and I got a chance to sit down and do some run-as's the old-fashioned way in my studio. And today my guest is Steve Evans, and Steve's worked in the IT field for over 12 years, and he specializes in Microsoft technologies. He's consulted for small businesses on their IT infrastructure needs, as well as working for larger companies as a systems engineer. He's been an MVP for the past 3 years, and is a technical speaker at a variety of events, and we keep running across each other at various silly things. It's good to hear from you, Steve.
Hey, how's it going, Richard?
No rest for the wicked. I'm not complaining, you know, this is all part of the fun. But let's dig into some meat here, because you've been battling Hyper-V challenges.
Yeah, so I joined a company in the spring, mm-hmm. and it was kind of weird. It's a Hyper-V shop. They actually use Hyper-V top to bottom.
Wow.
And yeah, no, it's so I got to be honest, I've never worked that much with virtualization. I mean, I've been a customer of a team that provides me a virtualization layer a lot. But this is the first time I've really been truly hands-on in a large virtualization environment. And it's Hyper-V. And so I've learned a lot about, you know, kind of the gotchas and the things to really pay attention to with Hyper-V. So I thought we could have a conversation around that.
For sure. And are we talking about 2008 R2?
Yeah. So where I'm working, and probably where everyone else is working, yeah, it's 2008 R2. So, you know, you call it V2 of Hyper-V.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, a lot of cool stuff is coming out with Server 2012 with, the third version of Hyper-V. But, you know, I think a lot of these things we'll talk about today are still, you know, they're still relevant.
Yeah.
And a lot of these are relevant regardless of whether it's, you know, you're using VMware or whatever. But yeah, Server 2008 R2 is what I'm specifically working with.
Current version. And like you say, really only the second version of Hyper-V. So, I mean, folks are waxing poetic about 2012 being the one. But it's nice to hear that there are folks that were working with R2 that are having success.
Yes, those of us who... it's like the scouts in the army that go out and, you know, risk their lives for others. So it's better
right.
when everyone else comes along.
You took some arrows in the back, but you're there. because, of course, the main product out there is VMware. And I guess that's a lot of folks have got a battleless idea of, well, why wouldn't I just buy VMware? I guess that, you know, therein lies the real question.
Yeah. So, you know, without getting into specifics of why my company uses Hyper-V, mm-hmm. I think for most people, it's the two big things are, one, you said it right there, you have to buy VMware.
Right.
Where arguably Hyper-V is free. I mean, obviously it's you can argue the semantics about what free means.
Yep.
But from a licensing perspective, Hyper-V truly is free, because you're going to buy a data center license to cover your physical cores. That just covers everything. And realistically, with VMware, you're going to buy the VMware license, and then you're going to buy Windows data center licenses to cover all the virtual
right.
machines.
And you're going to do that whether you're running VMware or not.
Unless you're a really small shop, yeah, you're buying data center licenses.
Right.
And then the other thing is, it's a comfortable, familiar interface. In a large environment, I don't think that's as big of a deal. You're going to probably have a team that specializes in VMware.
Sure.
Who are very comfortable with VMware. And even a medium-sized environment, you know, you're going to do enough in VMware to be comfortable with it. But, you know, if it's Windows Server. You know, there's a lot of things that are nice about you just have Windows Server. You don't have to learn VMware. Mm-hmm. But I think therein lies the problem is I think a lot of people are like, oh, I'll just use this Hyper-V thing because I just install Windows Server and I check a box and I got Hyper-V. And
they don't actually take the time to really learn anything.
And then you run into big issues there. You run into, you know, it's like SQL Server. You can install it, and for a small workload, it's going to be perfect. The defaults are going to be fine. Nothing's going to kill you. But when you start to put a real workload on SQL Server with, you know, having not thought out and made a plan, you know, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And the same thing with Hyper-V. If you just want to throw up a box and put a few VMs on it, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to shoot yourself in the foot. But if you're going to build out, you know, large Hyper-V clusters and run, you know, a large workload on them, then you really need to plan. But really, I mean, so what I'm saying is if you're going to do, you know, big production, you need to plan, which sadly is a point that sometimes we have to remember is you can't just throw stuff up. You have to plan ahead.
Now, where's the line? Is it as soon as you start clustering or as soon as you start putting stuff under real load? Like, you know, where am I going to get in trouble from just the throw it up to the, okay, we got to take this seriously?
So I think it's both. I mean, I think it can be both. You know, if you got a standalone box and you put 5 or 6 VMs on them that do serious workload, and you got a single 1 gig NIC on them, you're probably going to suffer some pain. Now, you're not going to suffer the pain of doing that same thing with a six node Hyper-V cluster and a single 1 gig NIC, and then how backups work with the redirection state and all. You get yourself in trouble. So it's probably less pain if you're doing standalone boxes.
Right.
But if you're doing standalone boxes, then you got to be really careful how you plan other things. Cause you lose some of the flexibility that clustering gives you. Let's go through my list and we'll kind of talk about, you know, which ones fall in which camp. And so the first one that's really not Hyper-V specific is look for those single point of failures.
Right. So really we're addressing the reliability issue, which in my mind, most of the time is the first major issue, more so than performance.
Yeah, except when we get to my second point, there's a couple areas where poor performance can cause reliability issues in Hyper-V.
So first off, single points of failure.
Look for single points of failures. A good example is I was working on a cluster that had each host had 2 10-gig connections.
Okay.
And then the Intel NIC software was used to bind those two together. And then used to create about 4 or 5 different virtual network cards off of that that created, you know, for different VLANs.
Okay. And so would each VM have access to one of those VLANs or were they sharing them?
So the way it worked we had one VLAN for management, one VLAN for live migrations, one VLAN for heartbeats, a couple VLANs for the iSCSI traffic, and then a VLAN for the VM trap, you know, the VMs to be connected to, you know, for their primary interface. But remember, those all tied back to those 2 10-gig connections. And the single point of failure ended up being the Intel software that was binding those two Intel NICs together. And what happened was we had a switch go flaky on one side, on one of those two paths.
Right.
The physical paths. Now, if it would have just failed, we would have been fine. The Intel software would have handled that just fine. It would have just failed over to the other card. Life would have moved on. I wouldn't have gotten the phone call at 2 a.m.
Yeah, you would have got a nice log entry that said, this NIC is dead. We've switched over to this.
Right, exactly. We would have had an incident in our ticketing system in the morning. We would have dealt with it. No issues would have happened.
Failures never go that way.
Instead, it just flapped, and I could log into the hosts, and I could watch the NICs connect and disconnect. It was just constantly happening.
Wow.
And so what happened was, remember, I said they were bound together and then split back out again. That single point of failure, that bound together part, caused network disruption across the entire host. We lost enough hosts that we lost quorum, and we took down you know, a significant number of apps in the middle of the night. So at first glance, you know, when you first explain this issue to people, they say, oh, you got the 2 physical paths. It's redundant. But you have to remember, you're tying back into a single location. So you need to think that stuff through. And and really dig into, do I have single point of failures, or do I just have a bunch of redundancy that all ties back to a single point of failure?
Right. Well, and it's the thing is, you're going to find those single points of failure eventually. You're just going to find them the hard way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that was a, you know, that was one of those 19-hour days for me.
Yeah.
So no kidding. I'll remember that one for a while. We call it, at the office, we call it Black Thursday.
Black Thursday. It was a bad day. Well, and it seemed like, you know, the whole thing there was the binding of them together. If they had been separate, one of them could have failed and the other one just would have carried on. You would have been fine. But because of the binding, which seemed like a good idea at the time.
Right, exactly.
You broke it.
And I was, so since that incident, I've worked with our Microsoft TAM got us a Hyper-V, a guy that works for PSS on for Hyper-V,
mm-hmm.
To sit down with us for a couple hours. And one of the points he made was, Intel does a better job at this than Broadcom, but Intel's still not very good at it.
Right.
So he recommended not, he said, if you're going to use it, use it in failover, not load balancing mode.
Right.
So just use failover. Don't try to use both of them to double your bandwidth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And of course, this changes in 2012, where the whole binding mechanism is different now, and they're trying to make it more standardized. But let's not even go there. Because it's not. It's got nothing to do with the fact that you can bind NICs together. So it has everything to do with don't create single points of failure.
Exactly. I mean, that's the example. So don't get caught up on the example. Just go through your environment and figure out, you know, where are my true single point of failures?
Right.
Which ties in very closely to my next point, which is look at your network config very, very closely. You know, so if you're using iSCSI, make sure you're using jumbo frames. Again, make sure you have that you truly have redundancy in your network. Make sure you have adequate bandwidth. And this becomes especially important if you're doing host level backups. You know, make sure that your backups, one, aren't going to swamp the network cards that other traffic needs. And two, make sure that because of the way CSVs and redirects works, we'll talk about that in my next point.
Yeah.
That you just have the bandwidth you need.
So, I mean, doesn't it just speak to this whole idea that you want separate switching, separate NICs, like keep iSCSI totally isolated from everything else?
I think, so in my personal opinion, and this is very much in the opinion category, because I don't really go below the virtualization. I usually stay up like in the IIS and the like kind of more the DevOps space.
Right.
So this is pretty much as low as I go on the stack. It seems to me to make logical sense. To, you know, my gut tells me keep your iSCSI traffic separate from everything else.
Yeah.
Is it TCP traffic? Sure, but it's not. It's just a totally different animal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's your storage.
Yeah.
It's super super important.
And it's worth running. I mean, if you come at it from the mentality of keep it totally isolated, and then if you're going to VLAN it, you treat it that way, that you've got these high-end switches that are able to really isolate it, and you can do some port-level isolation and so forth. I can live with that. I just think it stresses the hell out of the fabric between these smart switches that I literally want isolated hardware for it.
Yeah, and I think you get into a deal there where you're talking about the shoulds instead of the what the realities are.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do the proper segregation? Do you know, yeah, but I think it puts more stress on your operational procedures. For example, I'm not a very good networking guy. So I tend to make things really stupid simple because I know I'm not going to make the right decisions.
Right.
When it comes to really complex stuff, I know I can do the basic stuff. So to me, it's just easier separate iSCSI into completely separate network. And then I don't have to be as smart.
Yeah.
And I think whenever we can make it so we don't have to be as smart and we can save our smart cycles for areas where we have to be smart, it just makes, you know, everything run better.
Especially when you're looking at the cost of good switches and the cost of failure.
Right.
The switches are cheap. Super cheap.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, let's keep moving on. You were talking about CSVs.
So CSVs, which is clustered shared volume. So this was introduced in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
2000. Basically, it allows for the Hyper-V role only for multiple nodes in your cluster to access the same LUNs.
Nice.
So you have these shared LUNs, and it allows node A running VM1 to be running, you know, there, and then node B running VM2 be on the same LUN, and they're able to sort out who controls what, and it works really well. The thing to be aware of is that when you do a host level backup, that while the VSS snapshot is going on, the the CSV volume is in what's called a redirected state.
Right.
So what that means is even though they can all access that LUN, whoever owns the LUN, whoever's the owner of the CSV, is the only one who can read and write traffic, or read and write data. So for example, if I have node A with VM1 and node B owns a CSV and the CSV is in a redirected state because a backup's going on, anytime node VM1 wants to read or write data to its disk, it has to go over the network, go to node B, ask node B to read the data, and then comes back across the network. So a couple things, so write performance, read and write, disk IO it performs extremely poorly.
Right.
In fact, I had a SQL mirror in this environment.
Ouch.
And they would just fail over constantly because SQL mirroring is very sensitive to disk latency.
Yeah.
It's basically saying like,
so it would fall far enough behind that it would decide it's not working. It would switch.
Yeah. It would just say, oh, something's wrong with me. I'm going to, you take over for me. And then it would just, do that a few times a night. And it can get so bad. So it can get so bad that you can have VMs, the operating system decides its disk drive is gone. Mm-hmm. So think about a VM. It doesn't know it's not a real boy.
Yes.
It thinks it's a real machine. So it goes to read its data. It goes to read something off its C drive.
Right.
And the C drive takes forever to respond because it's doing this redirection thing. And if you don't have going back to adequate bandwidth, properly segregated traffic, it could take a really, really long time. Eventually, your operating system, your guest operating system is going to just blue screen. It's going to say, oh, I don't have a drive.
I don't have a boot drive.
Right. And it will blue screen and power cycle, essentially.
Yep.
So here's what you need to do to work around this issue. The first one is make sure your backup solution does VSS backups.
Okay.
So the way it's supposed to work.
So this is the shadow copy backup.
Exactly. So the way it's supposed to work is your backup software comes into the host and tells the host, I'm going to back up all your VMs.
Okay.
So the host starts a VSS snapshot. The host then goes and tells all the guests, hey, we're going to do a backup. And so then the guests do their VSS snapshot. And then if the guests have any, for example, SQL, any VSS providers itself, it will go and tell, for example, SQL Server, hey, we're going to do a VSS backup. And then that rolls back up the line until the host is eventually hears from everyone, says, okay, we're ready. We've QS'd our disks. And then the host will go and tell your SAN provider, your storage backend, let's do a VSS snapshot. It will do a snapshot. The host will mount that snapshot and start backing up. And as soon as those VSS snapshots have taken place, the CSV volume leaves a redirected state.
Okay.
So we'll end up in a redirected state for under a minute, as long as it takes for all those VSS snapshots to take place.
Nice.
So not a big deal. But make sure, so for example, Commvault, the backup provider.
Yep.
Supports this on NetApp, does not support it on Compellent.
Hmm.
So you need to be really careful when you're looking at your backup vendor and your storage vendor that all the pieces play together.
Yeah, no kidding. It's interesting that it's sort of that mixed feature set. And you still absolutely need a third-party backup provider here.
Well, so you can use Microsoft DPM.
Okay.
It will do it the proper way.
Yeah.
It's just a matter, you do need a, you just need to make sure whatever backup vendor you choose, Microsoft or third party, that it supports all the pieces that are in play
right.
to make this happen. If it doesn't do that, it will remain in a redirected state for the life of the backup. Now, let's imagine we have a 3-node cluster. The backup software is going to come and back up node 1, all the VMs running on node 1. And it may have VMs scattered across all the various CSV LUNs it has. So all those LUNs will be in a redirected state. And then it will go to node 2, and it will have VMs spread across all the LUNs. And so then all the LUNs will go back in a redirected state. Hmm. And what you'll find is your LUNs are in a redirected state for the entire night, it's not just for the life of one backup window.
Right.
So it can be very... very, very painful.
Well, it's a hell of a performance impact. How do you clean up after that?
I don't know what you mean by clean up.
Like if I get there in the morning and see that we're still sitting in a redirected state.
Oh.
I mean, doesn't it naturally switch back when the backup's completed?
When the backup's completed, it almost always will leave a redirected state.
Okay, so
it will go back online. They can get...
And so then you have to just manually switch it.
They can get stuck, and then you can manually force it to go to leave the redirected state. But still, it's extremely painful. The only way you're going to get away with this being the case and not having it hurt you is either one, you just don't have much of a workload, so the redirection state doesn't produce enough traffic to hurt you, or you don't have anything. You know, if you're not a global company, if you don't have, if it's okay for performance not to be good in the middle of the night,
yeah,
then you're going to be okay.
Okay.
Otherwise, make sure you have a proper solution in place. Now, the other thing to be aware of is with CSV redirects, if you Google for this, you'll find a lot of people recommending ways to force which NIC is used for this CSV redirection traffic.
Mm-hmm.
The primary NIC, the first path for the CSV redirection traffic is the heartbeat connection.
Oh, in a cluster.
The cluster's heartbeat connection. There's okay. no way to separate that. Now, your heartbeats can prefer to use a heartbeat NIC and then use, for example, a management NIC and then, for example, use a live migration NIC.
Mm-hmm.
But the heartbeat NIC equals the CSV NIC. There's okay. no way to separate those.
So, meaning if you move the heartbeat NIC over to the management NIC, the CSV NIC's going to follow?
The CSV, yeah, exactly. There's no. So the point is, there is no such thing as a CSV NIC.
Right.
It's the cluster uses whatever these preferred heartbeat NIC is.
Right. And hopefully they don't conflict from each other, right? Because if you're actually saturating a redirected CSV NIC and the heartbeat gets overwhelmed or delayed long enough, like you could have a cluster breaking as well.
Yeah, in theory, you could. You could have... So let's go back. Let's say you had a single connection for all of your traffic.
Okay.
And you're in a redirection state.
Which means you're already in hell anyway.
Yeah. Besides that. So you're in a redirection state. So you got the CSV traffic. You still have to have the cluster communication, like heartbeats, for example.
Yep.
You have your VM traffic still going on.
Yeah.
Plus you have the backups taking place, presumably over that network card. And let's just hope you're not using that same network card for iSCSI traffic.
Yeah.
And so again, you really need to plan this through, think it through. What I recommend is have three NICs, one for management, one for the heartbeat / CSV,
yep.
and then one for live migrations.
Mm-hmm.
And then you set your preferences. So the heartbeat NICs used for heartbeat, and then management, and then live migration. And then the live migration traffic does the opposite.
Right.
Live migration, then management, then heartbeat.
Yep, I agree. And you still are talking about primary traffic. Like you could have another NIC just for... You know, big traffic loads. If I'm dealing with a group of web servers or, you know, anything that actually has a significant amount of traffic, I want another NIC for that.
Yes. And then I would have a couple other NICs, a couple other redundant NICs for your VM traffic.
Right. The actual workload. Remember, we're going to do work on this on things?
Right.
So yes. Here you are now, eating up three NICs just for living in the VM state, and then two or three more given on the kind of workloads you're doing.
Yeah. It's the year 2012. It's okay.
Yeah. And well, it turns out NICs are cheap, and I can buy quad board PCIe NICs now. They've got four 1 gigabit or 10 gigabit connections for a relatively reasonable price. I mean, no 10 gig stuff's cheap, but 1 gig stuff is wickedly cheap, and you can just have one slot with four NICs in it.
Right, exactly. And don't forget your iSCSI traffic as well.
Yeah, which always isolated, always. There's no such thing as too many NICs. All right. We keep talking about clustering. Now, we're clustering primarily for reliability?
Yes. I think so. Reliability and manageability.
Right.
So, here's how I do it. I think of a Hyper-V cluster as a pool of resources. And fortunately, a marketing team coined the term of cloud, a private cloud. So, we have this pool, and we stick VMs in it. And that pool can have a certain amount of capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And then we stick VMs up to that capacity.
Right.
The nice thing about the cluster is we can balance that workload out. We can either do it manually or you know, System Center, VMM can do it for us, where we can balance that load out. We don't have to, we're not assigning VMs to a host. We're assigning VMs to a pool. We're assigning
right.
them to the cluster.
Right.
And they just balance it out. The other really important point about clusters is if, you know, we now have a piece of hardware running, possibly 5, 10, 15 VMs on it.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes wrong with that piece of hardware, we don't want to take down 15 services with it. We want those services to move to another VM and, continue to run. Or if we're going to do maintenance, we want to live migrate the VMs off and be able to do maintenance on that one and then live migrate them back. So it just gives us a lot of management flexibility as well as reliability.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things you have to be really conscious of is we have these nodes in a cluster. How many of those nodes are going to be reserved for when things go wrong? So, for example, let's say I have a 3-node cluster, and let's say I've determined that in between these 3 nodes, they're capable of running, 300 gigs of RAM and 30 virtual CPUs, just mm-hmm. completely making numbers up here.
Right.
If I assign VMs that use 30 virtual CPUs and 300 gigs of RAM, when either I do maintenance on one or one fails, I'm now going to have performance degradation, or I'm going to have VMs fall offline.
Yes.
So we need to decide how many hosts do I want to withstand failure of? Now, this is, again, highly in the opinion column. What I've chosen to do is build 6-node clusters, and I reserve 2 of the nodes. So when I do my math for my pool, I figure out what capacity does each host have, and I multiply it by 4. And what that gives me is I can be doing maintenance on one, so I can be patching it, I can be doing whatever I'm doing on it and not have to be stressed because I still have another one that can fail before I start to hit performance degradation. If I would have just reserved 1 instead of 2, whenever I have one offline for whatever reason, I'm now in a situation where any failure will put me in a really bad state. So that's the methodology I've chosen at the company I'm at. And it meets my business requirements.
Cool.
Obviously, you may have different business requirements and, you plan accordingly. But just stick to that philosophy of how many nodes am I willing to lose and reserve that capacity.
Right. Well, and you've got to tolerate at least 1.
Yes, at a minimum.
We know none is crazy. Even 1 seems, I guess it depends on the ratio, right?
It depends on your size. So yeah. if you have a 3-node cluster, reserving 2 becomes much more expensive.
Sure.
That's what I like about the 6-node clusters. So it's just like Goldilocks and the 3 Bears. 6 nodes is not too big. It's not too small. In my opinion, it's just right. And so we have 33% overhead. We have a third of the nodes reserved for flexibility and failure.
Right. And they are all symmetrical hardware. Like they're basically identical sets of gear.
I'm lucky right now. They're all inside the cluster. They're identical.
Right.
And when the next time we order machines and they're a different type of hardware, we will build a new cluster.
Yeah.
Or new clusters.
But it's also that attitude of you buy in 6-packs.
Exactly. Yes.
And you build a new 6-pack cluster. You transfer certain workloads from the old cluster and then you repurpose the old cluster as necessary.
Exactly. The other thing, if you're going to mix hardware, mm-hmm. be very careful about CPUs. So you don't have to have the same CPUs, but you have to have the same instruction sets. Otherwise, you have to put the VMs in CPU compatibility mode, which basically means, use the least common denominator when it comes
make
to their
them
instruction
run
set.
Sol. And are you purely talking just to AMD versus Intel?
No. So I'm talking the difference between generation X of Intel versus generation Y.
Okay, so that
generation
important.
Y has a newer instruction set.
Yeah.
It can do newer, cooler things. Operating systems don't support your instruction set changing midstream,
right?
Which would happen in a live migration scenario.
So we get back to this idea: if you buy a symmetrical 6-pack,
then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, it's because there's so much little. I've run into this grief. Like, there's so much little grief when that set of gear isn't the same.
And it goes back to that concept of, can you do it? Yeah, you can do it, but it takes a lot more thought. Simplify your life.
Same reason you want a separate switch for your iSCSI, because if you don't have to deal with this, you've got much better things to spend your time on.
Exactly.
What about storage in that 6-pack? Where do you put stuff?
For me, it's all going back to the same SAN. Mm-hmm. I'm not a storage expert.
Right.
There's definitely, you could definitely think this out a lot you know, you could definitely do a much more complicated, you know, spread things out between different sands. It's going to depend on the size of your environment and whatnot. Sure. For me, it all goes back to the same sand.
Right. And if you're going to do a standalone six pack, then it could be an iSCSI receiver that handles all six, like this, and that has its own mirroring internally. There's a bunch of ways to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, I use Compellent, and it that all just gets abstracted away from me. It just does it. So, and the nice thing is we actually pay Compellent to do the sand management for us. So
nice.
Makes it even, it really, I said, I told you, I don't go below the virtualization layer.
Yeah.
I want to plug into a network and I want to plug into storage. I rely on other people to do that higher level thinking there.
Nice.
And now going back to this idea of I'm going to buy a six pack, make sure you plan for the ability to add capacity. Make sure that you're not going to tap out your data center. Make sure you have the ability to add additional capacity. And you don't get yourself in a boat where you're just stuck and you don't know what you can do. The other thing to think about with cluster configuration and sizes and you got to think about the placement of the VMs. So think of if you have a two-node SQL cluster that is virtualized. Put one node on one Hyper-V cluster and put the other node on a different Hyper-V cluster.
Right.
And the advantage that gives you is if you were to lose a cluster, for whatever reason, you were to lose quorum on a cluster and all the VMs shut down, you don't lose your clustered SQL service.
Yes.
It will continue to run on the other cluster.
But, and you know, you get back to the reality, which is that once in a while, you lose quorum. Like this happens and it's happened to you. It's not a likely thing, but for a little bit of planning, you can tolerate that.
So, and that's the thing. Failures will happen.
Yep.
You will miss a single point of failure. Things will go wrong. And the job of IT is to plan for when things go wrong. And one of the ways to plan is don't make your SQL cluster have a single point of failure of being your Hyper-V cluster. So put one node on one cluster and one node on a separate cluster.
Yep.
Now, by contrast, if you have, everyone has these applications where you need these three VMs running for this service to be functional and none of them are redundant. Put those three on the same cluster. If you spread them between, let's say you only have two Hyper-V clusters, and let's say you spread them between the two clusters, if you lose a Hyper-V cluster, you lose your application no matter what.
Yep.
If you put them all on one Hyper-V cluster and you lose one of your two clusters, you have the 50-50 chance of losing that service.
Right.
So redundant, HA applications spread out across clusters, Hyper-V clusters, non-HA applications co-locate on the same cluster.
Right. All right, sir. I think we're just about out of time. Any final words, concerns, get this done?
Real quick on CPU ratios.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of... There's a couple things I've learned about how Hyper-V works with CPUs. It's really important. The lower the ratio of virtual CPUs to actual physical cores, the better. It means less context switching.
Sure.
Microsoft recommends a 2-to-1 ratio for critical workloads. That means two virtual CPUs for every physical core. And by the way, hyper-threading doesn't count. So you have to count the actual physical cores. 2-to-1 for critical workloads, which is defined as Active Directory, SQL Server, and something else that I can't remember right now.
Mm-hmm.
5-to-1 or better is recommended for general workloads, and 8-to-1 is supported. The real trick, though, is, well, not a real trick, but one thing you have to remember is, so you count up all your VMs and how many CPUs you have, you have to remember to count the host partition.
Right.
So when you install Windows Server, when you check that Hyper-V box, the Windows Server that you installed turns into a Hyper-V guest, essentially. It doesn't look that way, but it is a Hyper-V guest. So if you have a 12-core host, you have to start off counting 12 CPUs. So right out of the box, you have a 1-to-1 ratio. Then if you add 12 virtual CPUs, you're at a 2-to-1 ratio. If you add another 12, so 24 virtual CPUs, you're already at a 3-to-1 ratio.
Okay. And where do you want to get to?
You want to get it to as low as possible. 5-to-1 or better is recommended by Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
8-to-1 is supported. They suggest 2-to-1 for critical workloads, which is Active Directory and SQL Server.
Right. So where do you keep your configuration at?
So right now we're sticking to 2-to-1 across the board.
Wow.
Okay. We're in a situation where we'd rather spend some money on hardware than have to worry about this. Basically, we're going to start at 2-to-1. We're going to see where we're at. We're going to do some performance analyzation at the host level and determine if we can go from there.
Okay.
Oh, another really important thing about CPU. If you have a 4-node guest and you jiggle the mouse, it has to go and find four cores, four available cores for you to be able to jiggle the mouse.
Huh.
So it for you, you'll see people that say, oh yeah, this is really important. I'm going to give it four CPUs, but it's a single threaded app. And so you'll see one CPU that's being used a lot and three that aren't being used at all. If you take that from a four CPU machine, virtual machine to a one CPU virtual machine,
yeah,
it will actually perform better because it's able to find physical CPUs faster because it only needs to find one of them.
So maybe you get this whole idea of just don't assign cores because you can. Assign them because exactly. You actually really, really need them. There is an overhead. Yeah.
So the guidance is assign two CPUs when you need two CPUs. And I know that sounds kind of like, it sounds like a survivor contestant comment when they do the little interviews. But it, you know, give it one CPU. If it's actually using one CPU, give it another. If it doesn't use it, then take it away.
Right.
But, you know, I'm looking at virtual machines I have now that have four virtual CPUs, and you see one of them at 50% and three of them at 2%.
Right.
And removing those three non-used CPUs will actually make, not only will it help with your ratios, it'll allow your VM to run faster.
Nice. Steve Evan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.